friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 122 of Dermasphere. And happy new year! I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and a general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me in 2024 is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And one of your many talents is wielding the pimping bell, which makes that happy sing-song chime. That pimping bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy or testable content. So perk up your ears for the pimping bell and for special guest, Dr. Steve Feldman! Hooray! Welcome back, Dr. Feldman.
It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, I'm glad I lived to see another new year.
Well, we're going to talk more about behavioral economics today. And those of our listeners who have not had the good fortune to listen to you before should know, well, I should let you introduce yourself, I suppose. That's our tradition.
Super. I'm Steve. I'm a professor of dermatology, pathology, and social sciences and health policy at the Wake Forest University School of Medicine in small town Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Aww.
And among many other plaudits, you have written a book, one of many books, I believe. You've got like over 12, but this one's called An Illustrated Dictionary of Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. Friends, I believe you can find it on Amazon. We are using it as a roadmap to talk about how behavioral economics can be applied to medicine. And people are predictably irrational. Behavioral economics is the study of how we can predict their irrational behavior. And chapter 8 is what we're talking about now. It's the decoy effect. I have to be honest, I have a little trouble wrapping my head around this one. Steve, I would love to hear your explanation.
Oh, yeah. I love talking about arcane, complex things that are really difficult to understand. You know, when we're making decisions between things, it can sometimes be very difficult because things will vary in different qualities. Something might be less expensive, whereas something might be higher quality. And now you're scratching your head, do I want to spend more money for the higher quality? How do I choose between these two things? It's not an apples to oranges comparison. Well, it turns out if you add a third choice that's clearly worse than one of the other two, but not worse than the other, it makes it easy to choose the thing that it's worse than.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have some, you're comparing two things, one's more costly, but it's of higher quality. If you add a third thing that's even more costly, but of lower quality, then it allows you to choose the higher quality item. On the other hand, if you added something that was, let's see if I get this right, higher cost than the lower quality item, but of equal quality, again, it allows you to choose the lower cost item.
So people who own stores can kind of sway their customers to buy one product or another by putting out some decoy. They don't expect anybody to buy the decoy, but it's just there to drive sales of one particular item within this couplet. And I'm sure it becomes more complicated from there.
Yes, nobody should buy the decoy because it's clearly inferior to one of the two items.
So if you ever find yourself staring at three items and one of them is obviously the wrong choice, then you should be suspicious. And if you're behaving rationally, you can just ignore that thing and just compare the other two directly. But because we're irrational, it's really hard to ignore that thing and include it in our comparisons.
Yeah, the decoy effect, I guess, is not all that arcane or hard to understand. But it's not something that we would normally think to do.
I just keep thinking about wooden ducks, and it has nothing to do with wooden ducks.
Yeah, I guess it depends. If you had some really expensive, high-quality wooden ducks and some low-quality, inexpensive ones, and you're trying to figure out which wooden ducks to buy, you know, if you just added some low-quality ones that were higher cost, then you'd have an easier time choosing.
Man, that would be a nice looking duck on my shelf. I want one now. So in medicine, you comment in the book that perhaps we can use this phenomenon to kind of direct patients toward particular treatments. So if they're trying to choose between two different options, we can say, well, there's this other one, but it's the decoy, but it directs them toward the one that we think would be most beneficial for them.
Yeah, you know, I think of everything from the vantage point of psoriasis. So, for example, we've got biologics. So they're terrific drugs. All of them are great as far as I could tell. And I've taken money from all the companies that make them. So keep that in mind. But if I was giving patients a choice between, say, an IL-17 drug and an IL-23, they might go, oh, this one's faster, but this one's safer. This one, should I get the faster or do I want the safer? But if I gave them a third option that was, you know, equally safe but less fast, it might guide them towards one of those options. Or I could, you know, make a similar decoy that would lead them towards the other option.
Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we talk about things like quality and price, but as you just mentioned, there are other metrics where people might base their decisions too, like how quick it is to work, how safe it is, how convenient it is. So if something was dosed less frequently, for example, that might help sway them as well.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I'm talking about the newer biologics for psoriasis, I'll talk about some of our older ones that had to be taken even sometimes twice a week or every week. And you sort of kind of go over the different therapeutic protocols and response rates with the patients and the costs and sort of use that to sort of help frame the decision and help them to choose something that's going to work for them. But I do sometimes think that including that both historical information and still available therapeutic helps people see that there's a range of these things. There's different amounts of comfort that we have with all of them and give the patients a little bit of a nudge to make a decision if you've got somebody who's stuck. Because that happens too. People have decision arrest.
You sound like you like to spend a lot more time with educating patients than I do. you know, I think we talked in a couple of episodes back about giving them a default option and just making it really easy for them to choose the one you want instead of trying to educate them about all these details.
The default option is like the opposite of the decoy. Just the one thing. Go with that.
Most
one
of my patients
duck,
with this.
The best for everybody.
Do well on this.
Everybody likes this particular wooden duck. Look at it. What's not to like?
This is the wooden duck people usually choose. But we have 1,000 other ones you could look at and think about if you want.
Give me that room in the back of the office, you know.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Steve. And listeners, of course, you can find the other episodes featuring Dr. Steve Feldman in our archive. And you can also find all of his works on PubMed. And again, you can find the book on Amazon. Steve, good having you. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure.
Well, that was a great discussion as usual. What we're going to talk about now is kind of an itchy situation. So I have a great article out of Pediatric Dermatology from 2015, a bit of a vintage article, discussing the use of excipients in oral antihistamines and their ability to perpetuate allergic contact dermatitis. So an excipient is an inactive substance. It can be the vehicle or the medium for the active substance, and it can cause allergy in patients who are susceptible. The chief authors are Elizabeth M. Tochi and Diane L. Silvestri. In the abstract, they discuss the fact that propylene glycol is a well-documented causative agent of allergic contact dermatitis and can also cause systemic dermatitis after you ingest foods or medications that contain it. It can also occur after intravenous injection of a medication with propylene glycol as its base. In this article, they describe two adolescent patients that had sensitivity to propylene glycol, which had been confirmed by patch testing, and their dermatitis improved dramatically after cessation of the oral antihistamines containing the propylene glycol. Both of them, one through kind of happenstance and the other through an intentional rechallenge, were re-exposed to the oral antihistamines containing propylene glycol and developed exacerbations of their allergic contact dermatitis. So the authors report these cases to help alert providers to the potential for worsening allergic contact dermatitis from systemic exposure to propylene glycol in patients who are sensitized to it. So why do we use propylene glycol, Luke? It's one of those things that seems to cause a lot of trouble when it turns up as a positive patch test allergen, but why do we use it in the first place?
I just super like the taste of it. Kind of got hooked on it in med school. Do several shots every night.
Shot. Just kidding. It can be in shots. Injections, in fact, can contain propylene glycol. But the reason that it's used is it's a versatile chemical. It has low toxicity in general. It can be used as a topical medication or an oral medication. It can be used in personal care products and even in foods. If you're familiar with a liquid drink mix called Mio, propylene glycol is, I believe, the second ingredient on that in that ingredient list. And there's a lot of other foods, drinks, medications, and other topical medications as well that contain this product. It's used on the skin because it actually helps to penetrate the stratum corneum. So it has a lot of uses, but in patients who are sensitized, it can be problematic. There are, of course, reports of patients with allergic contact dermatitis to propylene glycol who developed systemic dermatitis after ingesting propylene glycol in foods or oral solutions. And a systematic reaction to patients previously sensitized to propylene glycol has also been reported from a patient who was given IV Valium that had propylene glycol as the base of that medication. So in this report, they discussed two adolescents that were patch test positive to propylene glycol. Now, it's important to note that propylene glycol is in high concentrations an irritant substance. It is tested at a safe concentration by the American Contact Dermatitis Society, but you can still have temporary irritant reactions. So if you only have an erythematous reaction to propylene glycol at the 48-hour read, but not at the 96-hour read, then you would typically interpret that as irritant, not true allergy. The allergic reaction should persist longer than that. So for the case reports, they had a 13-year-old boy who had a two-year history of eczematous eruptions. He'd had lots of different topical corticosteroids with temporary improvement. When they examined him in clinic, he had lichenified dermatitis. They decided to do patch testing for this child and found him to be positive to both propylene glycol as well as nickel, cobalt, and benzyl alcohol. His dermatitis improved dramatically once they eliminated propylene glycol-containing and fragranced personal care products, and they switched to propylene glycol-free topical betamethasone dipropionate ointment. Propylene glycol is in a lot of topical steroid medications and preparations. It tends to be absent from the desoxymedazone or Talpacort brand of topical steroids, and you can also find the propylene glycol-free formulations in some different resources we're going to talk about later. To control an ID reaction, the patient also had his middle orthodontia replaced with ceramic orthodontics. He had a flare of his rash twice during seasonal use of oral cetirizine syrup, which led to the discovery that the formulation he was using had propylene glycol. When they substituted an alternative propylene glycol-free antihistamine, he improved dramatically. So that's case number one. Case number two, they had a 14-year-old girl with a lifelong history of atopic dermatitis that had worsened in the subsequent 2 years. She'd been treated with topical steroids and emollients, bleach baths, narrowband UVB, and oral antihistamines with minimal improvement. They did patch testing for her, and she was positive only to propylene glycol. That reaction did persist at 96 hours, so it was interpreted as a true allergy appropriately. She had some improvement with discontinuing the topical preparations with propylene glycol and had complete resolution after switching to propylene glycol-free hydroxyzine syrup because her previous formulation had contained propylene glycol. She was intentionally rechallenged with the oral hydroxyzine containing propylene glycol and again experienced a generalized dermatitis. Fairly good confirmation that she was flaring because of that systemic exposure. So these are good illustrative cases to discuss patients with reactions to propylene glycol and the possibility of flaring of their dermatitis with ingestion of that chemical. As I said, the propylene glycol is a known irritant, so you do have to interpret the patch test results both at the 48 and 96 hour reads, and you have to use the proper concentration to avoid a persistent irritant reaction. Both patients had the patch test positivity to the propylene glycol, but were patch test negative to the topical steroids. They weren't tested for their personal formulations at the time of patch testing. Propylene glycol is a common excipient. Its presence is often overlooked, but it can cause generalized dermatitis, and ingestion can sometimes cause acute flares. It's ubiquitous in foods, personal care products, and also topical and oral medicaments. So elimination of exposure to propylene glycol can be difficult. Propylene glycol can be added to processed foods to thicken or moisten them. It can be present in things like store-bought salad dressings, packaged baked goods, dry ingredient mixes, and even fast food. There's a website called foodfacts.com. So foodfacts.com, all one word, foodfacts, to illustrate common foods that contain propylene glycol. This is a useful resource for patients. It details the ingredients of 75,000 foods. And for dermatologists, when we're treating patients who are propylene glycol sensitive, finding propylene glycol-free therapies can be difficult because these can be included in tablets, capsules, and syrups for antihistamines. You can also see it in topical productions. So there are also some websites that can be beneficial to check for the localization of medications and their excipients in commonly produced medications. There's a website called dailymed.nlm.nih.gov. This is a website sponsored by the National Library of Health, and it's a useful resource for prescribers. So you can kind of search it to find things like propylene glycol-free prescription medications so that you can potentially help avoid worsening of patients' dermatitis if they happen to be sensitized. There are some known propylene glycol-free or over-the-counter antihistamine preparations as well, and prescription ones. So the Cilarx Pharmaceuticals hydroxyzine syrup and the trade name Atarax syrup do not contain propylene glycol. Children's Benadryl, Children's Zyrtec, and Children's Claritin also do not contain propylene glycol as of the time of this publication. But we do know that drug companies can change the formulations of their medication, especially their non-active ingredients or their excipients, without making any kind of noise about it on the label. So patients who are sensitive should always check. So something important to think about, especially if you have patch test positivity to that common ingredient.
And I always like more data that suggests that you should not be treating your eczematous patients with antihistamines. I see a lot of patients with what I'm pretty sure is atopic dermatitis come into my clinic and they're on some antihistamines from their PCP, for example, and my feeling is that the itch related to atopic dermatitis doesn't really have much to do with histamine. Maybe there's something in there because the pathogenesis is so complex, but mostly antihistamines don't really help prevent eczematous people from being itchy, but they can help knock kids out and make them sleep, the sedating ones anyway. So if kids need them for a few days while we get a really good topical regimen under control, that's acceptable. But case studies like this suggest that they can make it worse. And of course, if you want to patch test somebody, first you have to get their skin clear enough to do it. And so it can be challenging. But I think another reason to say, maybe don't take these antihistamines, and let's focus on the skin for your patients who have eczematous eruptions.
I agree.
Well, we're not done talking about eczematous things. In fact, it's mostly going to be for the rest of the episode. Spoilers. So let's just talk about straight-up eczema or atopic dermatitis in this next article. And, oh boy, this next article. It has a ton of basic science information about the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis and some potential, somewhat unusual treatment options. It's out of a journal called Science Advances, and it was published in February 2023. The title is Exposure to Isocyanates Predicts Atopic Dermatitis Prevalence and Disrupts Therapeutic Pathways in Commensal Bacteria. The first author is Jordan Zeldin. The senior author is listed as Ian Miles. Also on the article are Larry Eichenfield and Eric Simpson. Hi, guys.
Woo!
So there's a lot going on in this article. So I'm going to do my best to synthesize the things that I think are the most relevant for us. And in the discussion section of this article, the authors refer to a construct in social science called the groundwater approach. So listeners, imagine that you come across a lake with one or two dead fish floating in the water. You'd probably want to figure out what was wrong with those fish. Mm-hmm. But if you came upon a lake with a whole bunch of dead fish, you'd probably think, huh, there's something wrong with the lake. Mm-hmm. And the authors suggest that since the incidence of pediatric atopic dermatitis in the United States has increased from about 2% to about 20% over the past 50 years, perhaps we should start analyzing the lake. Something in our environment rather than something in us that's responsible for this presentation.
I agree
and that
with
idea,
that.
Say again?
I agree with that.
That seems to be what drove all of the basic science experiments that they performed in this article, which largely examined the impact of various pollutants on commensal skin flora, which are thought to be protective against atopic dermatitis. Okay, so their research suggests specifically that pollutants called isocyanates disrupt the metabolism in the healthy skin version of a commensal bacteria called Roseomonas mucosa. And these isocyanates turn this poor bacteria into a version of itself more associated with atopic dermatitis. Coag-negative staph also seems to be protective against atopic dermatitis, and these isocyanates again seem to do the same thing, kind of turn it into the atopic dermatitis version of itself. In addition, they mapped zip codes based on atopic dermatitis prevalence and found that those with a higher prevalence of atopic dermatitis were associated with increased probable isocyanates in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's part of this one article. Like, they subjected these bacteria to isocyanates and they also mapped zip codes. These isocyanates have names like methylene diphenyl diisocyanate, or MDI, and toluene diisocyanate, or TDI, and they're common in a lot of industrial practices that manufacture products that we want companies to keep manufacturing, like furniture cushions. Can you imagine sitting on furniture without cushions, Michelle? Misery.
Also, I can actually, because I made a horrible couch when I was growing up out of, like, scrap wood that had no cushions on it at all, but out of, you know, childhood pride, I sat on it, and that was the most uncomfortable piece of furniture that I think has ever been made by human hands.
That explains your current posture. Also, nylon, paint, polyurethane, and adhesives involve some of these isocyanates, and there's a different kind of isocyanate, which is also called isocyanic acid, that is a component in wildfire smoke, tobacco smoke, and gasoline exhaust, all of which are also associated with atopic dermatitis severity. I think we discussed an article, I don't know, probably about 10 episodes ago, where they looked at wildfire smoke in California and how it was associated with an increased number of visits for atopic dermatitis. In addition to atopic dermatitis, isocyanates seem to be associated with other atopic diseases as well, such as peanut allergy, quote, general atopy, and asthma, but not allergic rhinitis. So in addition to all of this work that's already part of this article, in addition, these authors did a clinical trial of a probiotic cream that contained these sort of good for atopic dermatitis bacteria, these roseomonas things, in a phase 2b trial of 154 patients with atopic dermatitis. The patients did improve, but their improvement sadly was not statistically significant, and exposure to isocyanates abbreviated such improvement in mouse models of atopic dermatitis. So more suggestion that these isocyanates somehow impact these bacteria, which makes atopic dermatitis appear or become worse. The authors, of course, were disappointed that the treatment was not very effective, but they do comment on its favorable safety profile, potential long-term benefit, and wonder if it could be used for the prevention of atopic dermatitis in high-risk infants. In fact, they are so gung-ho about this that they state that they have renounced the patents on this bacteria. I actually didn't know you could patent a bacteria. And their preferred isolates are now available in various biobanks for interested researchers or laboratories. So if you might be one of them, they specifically comment on which biobanks you can find these in the article here.
That's pretty cool.
So a couple other interesting tidbits that come out of this article. So they comment that there are various environmental exposures that are known to induce various diseases in mice, and these exposures are used to create mouse models of various diseases, including isocyanates, creating a model of atopic dermatitis. However, when humans are exposed to similar environmental influences and develop organ dysfunction, like atopic dermatitis, we tend to call it a disease, not an expected reaction to this environmental exposure, and they question this distinction.
Interesting.
We are obviously still learning a lot about the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis. I personally often talk a lot about genetic predisposition and defects in barrier and/or inflammatory pathways with patients and their families. And these authors, of course, argue for the significance of environmental factors. This rise of atopic dermatitis from about 2% to 20%, coinciding with the rise of various industrial pollutants, is, you know, suspicious, but correlation is not infer causation, though, as our statistical friend Phil Watkins says, it's a good hint, because without correlation, you can't really have causation at all. They comment on some other proven environmental effects on atopic dermatitis. So apparently siblings are protective against atopic dermatitis. And I think you have about 20 brothers and sisters, Michelle, and to my knowledge, you do not have atopic dermatitis.
I have 7 brothers and sisters, and I do not have atopic dermatitis. Actually, none of my brothers or sisters have atopic dermatitis, so
well,
maybe you're
right. Proves it. Apparently, early life migration can be protective, and a, quote, urban-rural divide among genetically similar populations. The authors note that, quote, airborne diisocyanates were not among the many neurotoxic chemicals associated with autism or schizophrenia diagnoses, this was just news to me overall that there were some kind of chemicals that have been associated with these things. I felt that some of these bad neuropsychiatric issues were probably genetic for the most part, plus more recently being identified and diagnosed, which I assumed explained a lot of their rise. But again, perhaps there's something in the environment that's kind of scary, because those diseases are a lot scarier than atopic dermatitis. So that I hope that there's people looking into that and we're figuring out what to do about it. Mm-hmm. Also, they commented a common air purifier reduced the levels of isocyanates in the air considerably. And apparently there is some data that air purifiers can help with atopic dermatitis. There's so much going on in this article. I'm hoping to track down some of the citations and maybe we'll discuss them in some future episodes. But an air purifier is, as far as I know, fairly easy to get. Aren't they just like little machines that kind of look like Mr. Coffee that sit in the corner of your room and filter out the air? Or are they more complicated than that?
Most of them, like the HEPA filters, they're plug-in devices. You may have to change a filter in them from time to time, but they're generally pretty easy to use and pretty safe. Some people do talk about using a humidifier as well. Humidifiers get a little bit noisier because you have to make sure that they're not growing mold. If you're aerosolizing mold through a humidifier, you may be creating more problems than you're solving with that particular device. But with the air purifiers, so long as you're maintaining them properly, they should be pretty easy and safe to use.
I feel like I looked into the humidifier thing at one point too, and I think there's data saying it does not help in atopic dermatitis.
Well, Mr. Dr. Tarbox hates humidifiers.
Does he like air purifiers?
He does like air purifiers, yes.
Yeah, he's an allergist, by the way, listeners who haven't heard us mention that before. So that's the story. Interesting stuff. Again, more basic science, food for thought than stuff you can use in clinic tomorrow, but it's interesting that we know so much about atopic dermatitis and we have such good treatments for it, but we're still learning a lot more about it, and maybe suggest that your patients should use an air purifier instead of a humidifier, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's very interesting. The effect of environmental pollution on our flora, our enteric flora, our cutaneous flora, our pulmonary flora, I think is producing a lot of inflammatory disease, as well as kind of unmasking some genetic potential for other conditions. So many people are concerned that there have been increased prevalences of all kinds of potentially linked conditions to the presence of polluted chemicals in our environment, including things like autism and neurodegenerative disease. But I think we do definitely need to pay our diligence toward the effect that our water and air quality have. And with a mind towards equity, need to think also about the fact that marginalized populations may have greater exposure to these pollutants and contaminants and might experience worse disease and poorer health because of those things.
Which in turn could keep the populations marginalized. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a vicious cycle.
Exactly. So something definitely food for thought. You know what I think of when I think of food for thought, Luke?
Yes. You think of olive oil and Malassezia eating it.
How did you know where I was going with this?
Well, we've worked together for a long time, Michelle.
You basically just read my mind. That was scary. Get out of my head, Luke Johnson. Get out of my head. So
I will. It's scary in there.
So we're going to talk about now the efficacy of roflumilast foam, 0.3%, in patients with seborrheic dermatitis, which can be caused or exacerbated by Malassezia furfur, which we know likes to eat olive oil. You need to do an olive oil overlay in the lab to get that little fastidious organism to grow. This is a double-blind, vehicle-controlled, phase 2A randomized clinical trial. So phase 1 studies are generally to look at safety. Phase 2 are proof of concept and efficacy studies. A 2A is more going to be proof of concept and efficacy. A 2B is more dosing requirements. So here they're kind of proving if this works or not. Roflumilast is a PDE4 inhibitor. It exists also in the realm of pulmonary medication. It's a medication to treat COPD, but can also be used topically. There's already a topical cream that contains roflumilast. Roflumilast is an active ingredient called, I don't know how to say this, is it Zorive?
I'm not sure if it's supposed to be Zorive or Zorive. It's Zorive, approved for psoriasis.
Yes. So Zorive or Zorive, however you say it. So now they're here looking at a roflumilast foam, which I think is intelligent because sebderm can occur on the scalp, and applying creams to the scalp is cosmetically unsatisfying. There are currently not a lot of great treatment options for sebderm. We have some that work well for some patients, but all of us have had that patient that we're looking at and we go, I know this is sebderm, but nothing for sebderm is helping this patient. And so I'm hopeful that this might be something we can pull out of our toolkit for those patients. The safety and efficacy of roflumilastat 0.3% in adult patients was found to be quite both efficacious and safe in this study. This was a multi-center study with 24 sites. They had patients aged greater than 18 years of age that had a 3 month or longer duration of seborrheic dermatitis with an IGA investigator global assessment score of 3 or greater, which means at least moderate disease, affecting 20% or less body surface area, including the scalp, face, trunk, or intertriginous areas. They were applying once daily roflumilast foam or vehicle for 8 weeks. Now, if you've seen any presentations about Zoryve or talked to any reps about Zoryve, when they talk to you about the placebo data in their studies, they always have to give you this caveat that the vehicle for this topical is therapeutic. It's a very good moisturizer in emollient base. It's comparable to like applying CeraVe with regularity. So just improving barrier control can improve a lot of the conditions that this medication is designed to treat. But
wait, you're talking about the cream or the foam? Because this is a different vehicle here.
It's a very similar kind of foam though. They're both water-based. So the cream vehicle and the foam vehicle are both water-based and emollient. And both sets of studies showed similar higher than average placebo improvements, if that makes sense. Now, this is in contrast to the vehicles of some other previously studied PDE4 inhibitors, which have been problematic. Crisaborole, for example, has propylene glycol in it, and we all know causes some irritation with application. So in this study, they randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio patients to receive either roflumilast 0.3% foam or the vehicle foam for 8 weeks. And they looked at the investigator's global assessment at 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and 8 weeks. They were hoping to find an improvement of 2 points on the IGA. So going from 3 to 1 or 3 to 0 would, of course, qualify for that. An IGA score of 0 is clear. An IGA score of 1 is almost clear. So they're trying to get to clear or almost clear. They had 226 patients. Their mean age was 45. They had 116 men and 110 women. And at week 8, the IGA success rate, so dropping that 2 points on the investigator global analysis and a lower score on the IGA is better skin control. They had a 73.8 rate of achieving that in the roflumilast treated patients compared with about 40% with the vehicle alone. So as you can see, there was some therapeutic efficacy just to the applying the vehicle, but the drug was superior. And it sort of plays out in the analysis to be right around twice as effective as the vehicle for most of their assessments. The roflumilast treated patients had statistically significantly higher rates of IGA success at all time points, even as early as week 2. And they had reductions in the worst itch numerical rating scale. They had a significant improvement in that at week 8 of 59% versus 36% with the placebo. And the roflumilast was found to be well tolerated with low rates of adverse events. The results from this study did demonstrate favorable efficacy and safety, as well as local tolerability of roflumilast in the treatment of the erythema, scaling, and itch caused by seborrheic dermatitis. And that was going under further investigation as a potential non-steroidal treatment. The treatment options that we have so far for seborrheic dermatitis include things like selenium sulfide, zinc pyrithione. These are antifungal agents often used in a shampoo. We also often topically will use topical corticosteroids, but of course we do have to be aware of long-term risk for topical corticosteroids and the potential to cause atrophy, telangiectasia, or acne rosacea, and ocular toxicity. Topical calcineurin inhibitors are not approved by the FDA for sebderm, which makes it hard to obtain those to treat patients with seborrheic dermatitis. Sometimes if you get less specific and you just call it dermatitis instead of seborrheic dermatitis, you can get it covered, but it can be difficult to obtain. And if you do get it, it does have a high association of local site application side effects, including warmth and burning sensations. There's also a label on there that raises eyebrows in some parents and families when it talks about the potential risk for lymphoma or leukemia, and that can be discouraging of its use.
Yeah, but we've discussed articles on the podcast that says that doesn't happen.
I agree with you, but when you're talking to a parent or a scared patient that has like a family history of lymphoma or leukemia, it can be hard for them to get over that hurdle.
Sure. Also, I'm not sure I agree that it has a high risk of application site warmth and burning. I honestly don't see it that frequently.
I see it when it's on the face and they're already broken out. I try to calm down the rash with short-term topical steroids and then have them use the calcineurin inhibitor as maintenance. I think that that treatment regimen does better for most people. So I don't want to belabor the finer points of this article, but I will say that overall, most of the study metrics showed about twice as significant improvement with the use of the active therapeutic medication as opposed to the vehicle application. And in terms of adverse events, none of them were found to be very serious that were associated with the medication. They did have a patient in the vehicle group, so not the active medication group, that had an increased alanine aminotransferase level and anemia. That patient only had vehicle application. And the patients with the reflumilast, they had one patient with hyperkalemia and a migraine, which was not thought to be related to the treatment medication. So I thought that was quite well tolerated. The rates of topical discomfort with the previous PDE4 inhibitor crisaborole range between 13.8 and 31.7%. The reflumilast topical irritation rates were significantly lower. And in this study, they quoted a paper showing that tacrolimus ointment had difficulty with tolerability and burning sensation in 47% of their patients. So that was a study in reference number 10 here that was published in 2021, which is tacrolimus versus ciclopyroxylamine for maintenance in patients with facial seborrheic dermatitis. So another therapeutic for topical sebderm being compared to topical calcineurin inhibitors in that arm. And they do address the fact that the vehicle treated patients had a high rate of response because of the unique properties of the foam, which has beneficial effects on seborrheic dermatitis. As it is a water-based emollient vehicle, it has basically a similar emollient property to leading ceramide-containing moisturizers and gave some benefits because of that. The emulsifier is also not able to act as a surfactant at skin temperature and so doesn't extract lipids from the skin. That can be a problem in some topicals. We'll have an emulsifier in it that can act as a surfactant and actually break down skin oils and break down the skin lipid barrier and compromise barrier function. So those are very thoughtfully put together vehicles that I think is going to increase the successful use of this medication. I think they made a good demonstration of the efficacy of the drug as well as the tolerability of the active ingredient as well as the vehicle here. The big question to me is, of course, will it get approved by the FDA and will it be obtainable by the patients? Because you know, there's reactions I've seen with Zoryve in patients that have psoriasis or if we're trialing it off-label for other inflammatory dermatoses have been positive, but getting the medication covered can be a challenge.
I can help answer both of those questions, Michelle.
I'm very interested to hear.
Roflumilast was approved by the FDA for seborrheic dermatitis in patients age 9 and up in December of 2023.
Late breaking.
So there must have been a pediatric trial as well, though I honestly couldn't find it, even though I poked around on the internet for 3 or 4 minutes, which is an eternity for the internet time. it's approved. I don't think the foam is commercially available yet, but perhaps you could sort of get the cream and cite studies like this and the approval. The cost, so a 60-gram tube of the cream is $830, and apparently the foam is going to be the same amount, which is pretty pricey. And I don't often find myself, in fact, I am not sure I've ever found myself in the position of saying, man, I just wish I had better treatments for seborrheic dermatitis. I feel like most of my patients just do fine with the topical steroids and ketoconazoles and calcineurin inhibitors. But the few patients for whom I've tried roflumilast cream, usually it's like psoriasis in the like gluteal crease or in the genital area, they like it. It seemed to work pretty well, and it seems like a little bit goes a long way, and so even the little tiny like sample tubes can last people for a while. So I think it's a pretty decent medicine based on my limited experience with it, and sure, if you've got a recalcitrant sebderm patient, it seems like a reasonable thing to use. If like everything else, I wish it was cheaper, but you know,
mm-hmm. I know they
wishes
they,
were fishes are, then you have are... to analyze the lake.
There are that was a great callback, Luke. Very well done. And of course, we all recognize that there are development costs to these medications, and especially new medications are costly to develop. you know, the percentage of new medications that actually make it through the entire process to become commercially available is kind of a fraction of a percent sometimes for large companies. And so there is a lot of capital outlay to develop these drugs, but I do hope that these will be accessible for patients who need them.
This doesn't apply so much for Sebderm, but if you can keep somebody off of systemics with something like roflumilast, then obviously it's worth the cost. Jury's out on that as far as I know, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some people out there who could manage that way. Okay, one more study about itchy, rashy conditions. So this was again published just last year in 2023 out of Clinical and Experimental Dermatology, and it is called Randomized Double-Blind Placebo-Controlled Clinical Trial to Evaluate the Effect of a Mixture of Probiotic Strains on Symptom Severity and Use of Corticosteroids in Children and Adolescents with Atopic Dermatitis. This is out of Spain, and the authors include Marta Fieto Rodriguez and Vicente Navarro López.
Nice.
Thanks. I just fake it till I make it. But let's be honest, I'm never going to make it.
Yeah.
So this was a double-blind, randomized, controlled trial of a PO probiotic for pediatric atopic dermatitis that did show some improvement. I have some issues with it, which I'll talk about. But first, I'm going to talk about the trial, and then I'll get into my various issues. So there were 70 pediatric patients aged 4 to 17 with moderate atopic dermatitis by SCORAD, which is an atopic dermatitis severity metric. The patients continued their normal topical corticosteroids while they were on this, and the control group received one capsule a day of a probiotic containing three bacteria. Here's what they were called: Bifidobacterium lactis, Bifidobacterium longum, and Lactobacillus casei. If you're keeping track, they were all at 1 times 10 to the 9th colony-forming units per capsule. By the way, apparently the intestinal microbiota is altered in patients with atopic dermatitis, and there is some data about bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract playing a protective role against bacterial translocation from the intestinal lumen. So that's one potential pathomechanism where something like this could be effective. This was a 12-week trial, and at the end, the mean SCORAD improved by 5 points more in the placebo group, or in the treatment group, compared to the placebo. So both groups had improvement in their SCORAD scores. I'll talk more about the scores in a second. And in the treatment group, they improved by 5 points more on average. They also measured their IGA score. So that stands for Investigator's Global Assessment. And it's basically 0 to 4. How bad is it from nothing to severe? And the patients whose scores improved by 1 point or more was 91% in the probiotic group and 57% in the placebo group. The authors also examined whether or not those in the treatment group used less corticosteroid. And from start to finish, there was no significant difference between the groups. But if you just compared week 6 versus week 12, again, this is a 12-week study, there was a reduction in the grams of topical steroid used in the treatment group and the days in which the patients used it. So those in the placebo group, again, from week 6 to week 12, those in the placebo group used topical steroids 15% of those days, while those in the probiotic group used them 10% of those days. And then the median grams of topical steroid used over this time was 4 grams in the placebo group and 0 in the probiotic group. Median, not mean. So the authors conclude that probiotics could be a useful adjunctive treatment for atopic dermatitis in the pediatric population.
Interesting.
Okay, let's get into my issues.
Yeah, I'm interested in your issues now.
So in episode 45, we discussed an article that examined several trials, I believe 5 of them, of PO probiotics in atopic dermatitis. And they cited a 2018 trial by this same group that I'm talking about today that examined the same strains of probiotics in an extremely similar fashion, but with 50 patients rather than 70. And the conclusion was that it was effective with a mean improvement in SCORAD of 19 points over the placebo group rather than the study today, which was only 5 points. The patients in that 2018 study were restricted in terms of their diet. They had to follow a Mediterranean diet. And in that analysis of the trials, again, that we discussed in episode 45, that study was the only one of the 5 that the authors felt represented clinically meaningful improvement. And one of their comments was that all the other trials were performed in Asian countries, and they speculated that maybe the normal Asian diet just has more probiotics in it, like they eat kimchi and stuff. and Europeans don't eat so many probiotics in their natural diet. And so there's just less room to move the needle in terms of probiotics in the Asian population. So again, this trial that I just mentioned, this 2023 study of 70 patients, is a sequel, really, to that trial that they published in 2018. Same group, same strain, the methods are very similar. And their aim here was to confirm the results of their previous trial to allow more generalizability because of the avoidance of dietary restrictions and to measure the effect on corticosteroid use. Both studies were sponsored by Biopolis, which I think is actually a company called AMD Biopolis, which does seem to make probiotics, though the particular probiotic capsule used in this study does not seem to be commercially available, at least not easily on their website. Maybe they're laying the groundwork for it here. Okay, that study that we discussed in episode 45 introduced us to something called the minimal clinically important difference.
I remember that.
MCID. You remember this one?
I do.
You want to explain it to our listeners so I can take a drink of my water?
So basically, the article was discussing the fact that we can show statistical differences between different therapies or different treatment approaches, but they may not be clinically significant.
That's so, right. And that was originally introduced apparently in the journal Allergy in 2012, which used science and math and statistics to identify what they felt was a clinically meaningful change in particular parameters. So these various scoring systems that we have for, like, how bad is this particular disease in this patient, have some published MCIDs, minimally clinically important difference. So according to that, the MCID for the SCORAD is 8.7. So anything that improves the SCORAD by less than 8.7, they say, might be statistically meaningful, but is not clinically meaningful. So studies that show an improvement in those, in that SCORAD of less than MCID, since they're not clinically significant, this was sort of the main point in that article, that even though all five of these probiotic trials said that their stuff worked, they didn't reach the minimal clinically important difference, and so don't bother with probiotics. So this 2023 study, again, with the 70 patients here, showed this improvement in score out of 5.4, which does not meet the MCID. Interestingly, in the body of the text of this article, they note that they decided on a trial size of 70 patients because they felt that this was necessary to detect a, quote, clinically relevant difference of 5.3 points in the SCORAD. Though they do not have any reference as to where they found 5.3 being the yardstick for clinical relevance, and also it's sort of especially suspicious that it's 5.3 and 5.4 are so close to each other. I was unable to find other reports of a different MCID for the SCORAD. In addition, the confidence interval, right? So average improvement was 5 points in the SCORAD beyond placebo, but the confidence interval was 11 to 0, basically, 10.7 to 0.2, suggesting further that any difference could just be due to chance and less likely to be clinically significant. Speaking of SCORAD, let's learn about the SCORAD.
Let's learn.
Is a metric that ranges from 0 to 103. Mild disease is less than 25, moderate is 25 to 50, and severe is over 50. Patients who were enrolled in this study had SCORADs of 20 to 40, so they mostly had moderate disease. On average, the placebo group SCORADs decreased from 34 to 19, while the probiotic group SCORADs decreased from 34 to 14. Thus, both groups moved from moderate to mild. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical that this SCORAD improvement of an additional 5 points is clinically meaningful. The IGA improvement, remember this was 91% versus 57%, does seem like a bigger deal to me. This is one I use in practice a lot, this IGA stuff, because if somebody's goes from a 3 to a 2, then their disease has gone from moderate to mild. And that's more meaningful, I feel. And at least those data from this study make a bigger impact in my brain. In addition, though, the fact that the topical steroid use from week 0 to week 12 did not differ between groups would be further cause for skepticism. Though, again, they did see improvement if you compared week 6 to week 12. And I do imagine that probiotics would need some time to populate the gut and start working. And they do comment that they require a, quote, period of induction, so perhaps a longer trial would show a persistent decreasing steroid use. That'd be kind of nice. These authors did intend to check in on their patients 3 months after the intervention, but this was done in, like, 2018 to 2020, so the pandemic interfered with that plan, I'm afraid. This is Spain, remember. There were no significant adverse effects noted in this trial, and that study we discussed in episode 45 discussed none of those trials had any serious adverse effects. That they did point out that there are a number of case reports out there about probiotic-induced sepsis, so it's not 100% benign. Another problem, even if you feel that probiotics could help with atopic dermatitis, and you feel that this particular formulation does seem to have the best data, which I think is probably true, it doesn't seem to be available commercially. Again, this particular company doesn't seem to sell it, and I poked around on the internet for 5 or 10 minutes, and I wasn't able to find any products that included, like, just these three specific bacterial strains. So more frustration. Michelle, I think it would be nice if stuff like this worked. It would be a lot cheaper than some of our other interventions. I like the sort of holistic, integrative mindset behind it, but skeptical for the reasons that I mentioned. And also, it's pretty obvious to us in practice that medicines like topical steroids and tacrolimus and dupilumab and JAK inhibitors work really, really well for atopic dermatitis. And it just doesn't really seem like probiotics do very much. So despite the statistical significance of this trial, I'm still not feeling like I'm going to recommend it to my patients.
Understandable. I think that, you know, that is something that I want to work as well, because I think that I like the concept of a natural medication or trying to reestablish homeostasis and balance. I think that the perturbations that can occur in the flora can be difficult to overcome with just a single intervention, especially if there's chronic ongoing inflammation that's generated by more of a genetic component. So I think it's a part of the puzzle. I just don't think it's, I don't know that it's the magic key that unlocks the entire kingdom.
Certainly, it doesn't, at least doesn't seem to be crazy to do it if you had a family who wanted to. And you could indeed say, ah, yes, well, I know about these studies and this particular mixture has decent data. But it, again, we can't really recommend them a specific product because it just doesn't seem to be out there. Maybe this company will make one. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that is all for today, friends. Thanks for hanging around. And today, recall that we welcomed Steve Feldman on to discuss the decoy effect. We also talked about antihistamines sometimes having propylene glycol, which can cause systemic allergic contact dermatitis in susceptible patients. We learned about diisocyanates and isocyanates as part of the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis. We learned about roflumilast for seborrheic dermatitis, seems to work decently well and is now approved, and just talked extensively about this probiotic trial for atopic dermatitis. Thanks to all the members of Team Dermasphere who keeps the podcast moving along behind the scenes. They include Morgan Dykman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Lara Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, and Lior Lavin. Thanks very much for you guys. Some of what you do is keep our social media accounts trucking along. You can find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. Friends, if you feel that Dermasphere has brought some value to your life and you feel like you would like to give back, you can donate to the podcast at uofuhealth.org/dermasphere. If you want to see some of our video content, we do have some, again, thanks to Team Dermasphere for that, on YouTube and ViewMedi. And listeners, if you are looking for ways to hang out with Michelle and I, there's lots of ways to do so now. The University of Utah Department of Dermatology has a monthly Echo session that you are welcome to join for free. Get some CME, hang out with us. Link will be in the show notes. I still have room for a few more learners in a prurigo nodularis focused CME event. You go at your own pace. You learn about prurigo nodularis. You hang out with me a little bit. Again, the link will be in the show note for that one. And Michelle, do you want to also tell our listeners about Resident Jeopardy?
Ah, yes. So Luke and I will be hosting a Resident Jeopardy session at the AAD, and we're going to be pulling pearls from the Dermasphere to educate our younglings as they go on their quest for better and more information. It's always a lot of fun, even if you're not a resident, to come watch the teams compete. It's like regular Jeopardy, but with dermatology questions, and it can be quite entertaining.
And you can sign up for that on the AAD's website, I presume.
Yes, I believe so. I'm not sure if we have all the teams full yet or not, but it's always a really fun session.
Just to make sure we don't miss thanking anybody, thanks to Dr. Steve Feldman, of course, for joining us. Thanks to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Friends, happy 2024, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Woo!